I Believe by Tuesday Love Sang Rampa, read for you by Blue Friend in beautiful B.C. Chapter 2. Algernon Reginald St. Clair de Bonkers fell to the floor of the bathroom with a soggy scrunch. Algernon lay upon the floor, and from him there came bubbling, mewling sounds. Out in the corridor, a chambermaid who was passing stopped in her tracks and felt the icy fingers of fear crawl up and down her spine. Tremulously, she called through the door, "Are you all right, Sir Algernon? Sir Algernon, are you all right?" Receiving no reply, she turned the door handle and entered the bathroom. Immediately, her hair stood up on her neck, and drawing a tremendous breath, she let go with one of the most marvelous screams of her career, and continued to scream, getting higher and higher up the scale as she did so. Thoroughly out of breath, she collapsed in a dead faint by the side of Algernon on the floor. There came the sound of excited voices. There came the sound of pounding feet up the stairs and along the corridor. The first comers stopped with such abruptness that they tore the carpet from its fastening, then clustered together as if to give each other confidence. They peered in the open doorway. Algernon Reginald St. Clair de Bonkers lay upon his face on the bathroom floor, blood pouring from a gash across his throat and soaking the unconscious body of the chambermaid lying beside him. Suddenly, she took a quick gasp, twitched, and opened her eyes. For seconds, she looked at the pool of blood beneath her, shuddered, and then, with an eldritch scream which jarred the nerves of those around her, she slumped again into a dead faint, this time her face well immersed in the alleged blue blood of her employer. Algernon lay upon the ground. He felt that everything was spinning. Everywhere was fantastically unreal. He heard a keening, mewling noise, and then hideous bubblings which gradually became less bubbly as the blood seeped out of his mutilated body. Algernon felt very strange workings within him. Then there was a terrific screech, and the chambermaid fell down beside him, bumping his body in the process. With a sudden jar, Sir Algernon was pushed right out of his body and jumped upwards like a balloon on a string. For some seconds he looked about, amazed at the strange, strange viewpoint. He seemed to be floating face down from the ceiling, and then, as he gazed down at two bodies beneath him, he saw a silver cord extending from his new body to the old one lying supine upon the floor. As he watched, the cord turned dark gray. Hideous spots appeared where it joined the body on the floor, and then it withered and dropped away like an umbilical cord. But Algernon stayed there as if glued to the ceiling. He made loud shouts for help, not realizing that he was out of a dead body and into the astral plane. He stayed there, stuck against the ornamental ceiling of the ancestral home. He stayed there, invisible to the gawking faces which peered into the bathroom, took an inordinate time to look around, and then disappeared to be replaced by others. He saw the chambermaid recover consciousness, gaze at the blood into which she had fallen, screech and faint again. The heavy, studied voice of the butler broke the silence. No, no, he said, let's not have panic. You, Bert, pointing to a footman, go and call the police. Call Dr. McIntosh, and I think you should call the undertaker as well. Having concluded that oration, he gestured imperiously to the footman and turned to the two bodies. Pulling up his trousers so they should not crease over his knees, he stooped down and very gingerly caught hold of the wrist of the chambermaid, exclaiming in extreme distaste as his hand encountered blood. Quickly he removed his hand and wiped the blood off on the chambermaid's skirt. Then, grasping the poor maid by one leg, by one ankle, he pulled her straight out of the bathroom. There were subdued titters as the poor maid's skirt rolled up around her waist and up to her shoulders. Titters were quickly suppressed at a glare from the butler. The housekeeper stepped forward and demurely bent down and, in the interests of modesty, rearranged the chambermaid's skirts around her. Then two men servants lifted the chambermaid and hurried down the corridor with her, trailing blood from her blood-soaked clothes as they did so. The butler eased further into the bathroom and looked cautiously around. Yes, he said, there's the instrument with which Sir Algernon ended his life. He pointed to a blood-stained open razor which had skidded along the floor to the side of the bath. He stood like a monolith in the bathroom doorway until the sound of galloping horses was heard outside. Then there came the footman who said, "The police are here, Mr. Harris, and the doctor's on his way." There were excited voices in the hallway, and then a very heavy, majestic tread came up the stairway and down the corridor. Well, what do we have here?" said a rough voice. "I understand that there's been a suicide, but are you sure it's not murder?" The speaker, a policeman in blue uniform, poked his head into the bathroom, automatically reaching for the notebook ever ready in his breast pocket. Taking the stub of pencil, he licked it and then carefully opened the notebook. Then there came the sound of a fast-trotting horse and more commotion at the doorway, followed by a much lighter, much quicker tread on the stairs. A slim young man came along, carrying a black case. "Ah, Mr. Harris," said the young man, who was in fact the doctor, "I understand you have some illness here, some tragedy maybe, eh?" Now, doctor," said the red-faced policeman, "we have not finished our investigations yet. We must find the cause of death." "But, Sergeant," said the doctor, "are you sure that he really is dead? Shouldn't we see to that first?" Mutely, the sergeant pointed to the body and to the fact that the head was almost cut off from the neck. The wound gaped wide open now. All the blood had drained out of the body and seeped all over the bathroom floor and all along the carpet in the corridor. The sergeant said, "Now, Mr. Harris, let's have your account of it. Who did it?" The butler licked his nervous lips, as he was not at all happy at the way things were turning. He felt as if he were being accused of murder. But even the meanest intellect would have seen that the injuries on the body were self-inflicted. But he knew he had to keep in with the law, and so he started. "As you well know, my name is George Harris. I am the head butler in this household. The staff and I were startled to hear a chambermaid, Alice White, screaming, her voice going higher and higher until we thought that our nerves would break under the strain, and then There was a thud and nothing more. So we raced up here, and we found... He paused dramatically, and then thrust his hands in the direction of the bathroom and said, "This." The sergeant mumbled to himself and chewed at his mustache, a long, drooping affair which had trailers at each side of his mouth. Then he said, "Produce this Alice White. I will interrogate her now." The housekeeper came bustling down the corridor, saying, "Oh, no, you won't, Sergeant. We're having to bath her. She's covered in blood, and she has a fit of hysterics. Poor soul, I don't wonder at it either. Now, don't you think you can come in here bullying us because we did not do this thing, and I'll have you remember at all times you've come to my back kitchen in the dead of night to have a good meal." The doctor moved forward very gingerly and said, "Well, we'd better have a look at the body. We seem to be wasting a lot of time and getting nowhere in the process." So saying, he stepped forward and carefully took the links out of his starched cuffs, then put them in his pocket and rolled up his sleeves after passing his jacket to the butler for his care. Stooping down, the doctor carefully examined the body without touching it. Then, with a quick movement of his foot, he flipped the body right over until it was facing up, with the staring eyes gazing up. The entity who had been Sir Algernon was looking down in fascination at all of this. He felt very strange about it. For a moment, he could not understand what had happened, but some force kept him pinned to the ceiling, upside down, the living Algernon gazing down into the dead, glazed, bloody eyes of the dead Algernon. He rested upside down against the ceiling in rapt attention, spellbound at the strange experience. His attention was riveted at the words of Mr. Harris. Poor Sir Algernon was a subaltern in the Boer War. He fought very nobly against the Boers, and he was badly wounded. Unfortunately, he was wounded in a most delicate place, which I cannot describe more adequately in front of the ladies present. And increasingly of late, his inability to perform has led to bouts of depression, and on numerous occasions we and others have heard him threaten that life without his necessities was not worth living, and he threatened to end it all. The housekeeper gave a sniff of commiseration, and the second housemaid sniffed in sympathy. The first footman muttered assent that he too had heard such things. Then the doctor gazed at all the towels so neatly arrayed on the racks, and with a quick movement spread them all on the bathroom floor. With a foot, he swept away the blood, which even now was commencing to coagulate. Then, turning his eyes to the bath rail, he saw a bath mat there, quite a thick thing. He placed it on the floor beside the body and knelt down. Taking his wooden rod stethoscope, he unbuttoned the clothing of the corpse and put the wooden button end to the chest and applied his ear to the recessed shape in the wood at the other end. Everyone was still. Everyone held their breath. And then at last the doctor shook his head in negation, saying, "No, life is extinct. He is dead." With that, he removed his wooden stethoscope, tucked it inside his trousers in a special pocket, and stood up, wiping his hands on a cloth handed to him by the housekeeper. The sergeant pointed to the razor and said, "Doctor, Is that the instrument which ended this body's life? The doctor glanced down, moved the razor with his foot, and then picked it up through the folds of the cloth. Yes, he said, this has severed from the carotid artery through the jugular and on to the carotid. Death must have been almost instantaneous. I estimate that it took about 7 minutes to die. Sergeant Murdoch was very busy licking his pencil and writing copious notes in his book. Then there came a heavier rumble, as of a wagon being drawn by horses. Again the doorbell pealed in the kitchen. Again there were voices in the hall, and then a dapper little man came up the stairs, bowed ceremoniously to the butler, to the doctor, to the sergeant, in that order. "Ah, is this the body ready for me?" he asked. "I was asked to come here and collect a body, the body of a suicide." The sergeant looked at the doctor. The doctor looked at the sergeant. Then they both looked at Mr. Harris. "Do you have anything to say about this, Mr. Harris? Do you know if any of the corpse's relatives are coming?" asked the sergeant. "No, sergeant, they would have no time to come here so quickly. I believe the nearest relative lives about half an hour's journey by fast horse, and I have already sent a messenger. I think it would be in order to have the undertaker take the body away to his parlor, because, obviously, we cannot have the relative seeing Sir Algernon in such a deplorable condition, can we?" The sergeant looked at the doctor, and the doctor looked at the sergeant, and then, simultaneously, they said, "Yes." So the sergeant, as the representative of the law, said, "All right, take the body away, but let us, at the station, have a very full report at the earliest possible moment. The superintendent will want it before the morning." The doctor said, "I shall have to inform the coroner of this. It is probable that he will want to conduct an autopsy." The doctor and sergeant moved away. The undertaker gently shooed away the butler, the footman, the housekeeper, and the maids, and then two of his men came up the stairs, carrying a light casket. Together they put the casket on the floor outside the bathroom and removed the lid. Inside it was about a quarter full of sawdust. Then they moved into the bathroom, lifted the body up, dropping it unceremoniously into the sawdust in the casket, carefully putting the lid back into position. Perfunctorily, they rinsed their hands under the tap, and not finding any clean towels, they wiped their dripping hands on the curtains. Then out they went into the corridor, treading half-congealed blood all over the corridor carpet. With many a grunt, they lifted the casket and proceeded down the stairs. "Bear a hand here, you men," called the undertaker to two footmen. "Take the lower end. We mustn't tip him out." Two men hurried forward, and carefully the casket was eased down the stairs and out into the open, and slid into a black-covered wagon. The undertaker got inside, the two assistants got up on the box, and the reins were picked up and the horses ambled off at a leisurely pace. Sergeant Murdoch moved ponderously up the stairs again and went into the bathroom. With a cloth he picked up the open razor and put it aside. Then he carried out an inspection to see if anything else of use as evidence could be found. The spirit of Sir Algernon, glued to the ceiling, looked down in utter fascination. Then, for some reason, Sergeant Murdoch turned his eyes to the ceiling, emitted a bellow of fright, and fell down with a honk that cracked the toilet seat. With that, the spirit of Sir Algernon vanished, and he himself lost consciousness, being aware only of a strange humming, a weird swirling, and clouds of rolling blackness, like the smoke from a paraffin reading lamp which had been turned too high and left unattended in a room. And so darkness fell upon him, and the spirit of Sir Algernon took no further interest in the proceedings, at least for the time being. Algernon Reginald St. Clair de Bunkers stirred uneasily in what seemed to be a deeply drugged sleep. Strange thoughts swarmed across his half-submerged consciousness. There came bursts of heavenly music, followed by wild outpourings of hellish sound. Algernon stirred fretfully, and in one period of greater consciousness, he stirred and found to his astonishment that his movements were sluggish, torpid, as though he were immersed in a gooey mess. Algernon Reginald St. Clair de Bunkers woke up with a start and tried to sit erect, but found his movements constricted. He could only move in slow motion. Panic struck, and he tried to flail about in his anguish, but found his movements were slow, turgid, and it calmed him down quite a lot. He felt for his eyes to see if they were open or shut, because he could see no light. It did not matter if his eyes were open or shut. There was no sensation of light. He put his hands down to feel the texture of the bed. But then he shrieked in shock, because there was no bed beneath him. He was suspended, as he himself put it, like a fish stuck in syrup in a fish tank. For a time, he feebly flailed his arms as does a swimmer trying to push against something so he would have the satisfaction of getting somewhere. But as hard as he pushed with his widespread hands and arms and his thrusting feet, so did something hold him back. To his astonishment, all his efforts failed to make him breathless, failed to make him tired. So, having seen the uselessness of an attempt at physical effort, he just lay still and thought. Where was I? He thought back. Oh yes, I remember. I decided to kill myself. I decided that it was useless going on as I had been going on, bereft of female society because of the nature of my disability. How unfortunate it was, he muttered to himself, that the filthy boars should have shot me there. For some moments he lay there thinking of the past, thinking of the bearded boer who had raised his rifle and deliberately, quite deliberately, aimed at him, not with a view to killing him, but with the definite objective of what must politely be termed robbing him of his manhood. He thought of the dear vicar who had recommended Algernon's house as a very safe refuge for servant girls who had to earn a living. He thought, too, of his father, who had said, while the young man was still a schoolboy, "Well, Algernon, my lad, you have to get to learn the facts of life. You have to practice on some of the servant girls we have here. You'll find them quite useful to play with, but be sure you do not take things too seriously. These lower classes are there for our convenience, aren't they? Yes, he thought. Even the housekeeper had smiled a peculiar little smile when a particularly comely young maid, servant, was engaged. The housekeeper said, "You'll be quite safe here, dear. The master will not bother you at all. He's like one of those horses in the field, you know. They've been doctored." "Yes, well, you'll be quite safe here." And the housekeeper had turned away with a sly little chuckle. Algernon reviewed his life in some detail. The shattering impact of the bullet and how he had doubled up and vomited in anguish. Still, in his ears, he could hear the raucous laughter of the old Boer farmer as he said, "No more girls for you, my lad. We'll stop you from continuing the family name. Now you'll be like one of them there eunuchs we used to hear about." Algernon felt himself grow hot all over with the shame of it, and it reminded him of the long-term plan he had made, a plan to commit suicide following the decision that he could not go on living under such strange conditions. He found it quite intolerable when the vicar called upon him and made oblique references to his ailment, and said how glad he would be to have such a safe young man help with the women's meetings and the Sunday afternoon sewing sessions and all that sort of thing, because, the vicar said, "We cannot be too careful, can we? We must not impugn the good name of our church, must we?" And then there was the doctor, the old family doctor, Dr. Mortimer Davis, who used to ride up of an evening on his old horse, Wellington. Dr. Davis would sit down in the study, and together they would have a comfortable glass of wine. But the comfort was always ruined when the doctor would say, "Well, Sir Algernon, I think I should examine you. We have to make sure you do not develop any feminine characteristics, because unless we exercise the most extreme supervision, you may find that your facial hair will fall out and you'll develop female breasts. One of the things for which we must be most observant is for any change in the timbre of your voice, because now that you've lost certain glands, the chemistry of your body has changed." The doctor looked at him most quizzically to see how he was taking it, and then he said, "Well, now, I think I could do with another glass of wine. You have most excellent wine here. Your dear father was a great connoisseur of the luxuries of life, especially with the distaff side of the luxuries." Poor Algernon had all that he could take when, one day, he heard the butler talking to the housekeeper. "A terrible thing. You know how it happened to Sir Algernon? Such a lively, virile young man, such a credit to his class. I know well how. Before you came here, and before he went to the war, he used to ride to hounds and made a very favorable impression on the matrons of the district. They were always inviting Sir Algernon to parties. They always looked upon him as a most eligible young man and a very desirable suitor for a daughter who had just come out. But now, well, the mothers of the district look upon him with commiseration. But At least, they know he doesn't need a chaperone when he goes out with their daughters. A very safe young man. Yes, sir, a very safe young man, indeed. Yes, thought Algernon, a very safe young man, indeed. I wonder what they would have done in my place, lying there on the battlefield bleeding, with my uniform breeches soaked in red, and then the surgeon coming along in the field, cutting off my clothing, and with a sharp knife just amputating the tattered remnants of what made him different from a woman. Oh, the agony of it! Nowadays, there's this thing they call chloroform, which is stated to relieve pain, to give one surcease from the agony of operations. But on the field, no, nothing but a slashing knife and the bullet between one's teeth, so one can bite down on that bullet and stop oneself from screaming. And then, the shame of it! The shame of being deprived there. The sight of one fellow subalterns looking embarrassed and at the same time uttering salacious stories behind one's back. Yes, the shame of it. The shame of it. The last member of an old family, the debunkers, who came over with the Norman invasion and who settled in that very salubrious part of England and built a large manor house and had tenant farmers, and now he, the last of the line, impotent through service to his country, impotent and laughed at by his peers. And what is there to laugh at, he thought, in a man becoming maimed in the service of others. He thought that now, because he had fought for his country, his line would fall into desuetude. Algernon lay there, neither in the air, neither on the ground. He could not decide where he was. He could not decide what he was. He lay there, flapping like a newly landed fish, and then thought, am I dead? What is death? I saw myself dead, and yet, how am I here? Inevitably, his thoughts turned again to events since his return to England. He saw himself walking with some difficulty, and then carefully noting the expressions and the actions of his neighbors, of his family, of his servants. The idea had grown that he should kill himself, that he should end a useless life. He had, at one time, locked himself away in his study and got out his pistol, carefully cleaned it, carefully loaded it and primed it, then he'd put the muzzle to his right temple and pulled the trigger. Just a sodden thunk had resulted. For moments he just sat there, bemused, unbelieving, his trusty pistol, which he had carried and used throughout the war, had betrayed him at last, and he was still alive. He spread a sheet of clean paper on the desk in front of him and lowered the pistol onto it. Everything was as it should be. Powder, ball, and cap, everything was perfectly in order. He assembled it again, powder and ball, and loud bang, and he had shot out his window. There came running feet and a pounding on the door. Slowly he had risen to his feet and unlocked the door to admit a white-faced, frightened butler. "Oh, Sir Algernon, Sir Algernon, I thought some dreadful mishap had occurred," said the butler, in considerable agitation. "Oh, no, it's quite all right. I was just cleaning my pistol, and it went off. Get a man to replace the window, will you? Then there had been the attempt at horse riding. He had taken an old gray mare and had been riding out of the stables when a stable boy had tittered and murmured to an ostler, "Two old mares together now, eh? What do you think of that?" He turned and struck at the boy with his riding crop, and then flung the reins over the horse's neck, jumped to the ground, and hastened back to his home, never to ride a horse again. And then, another time, he thought of that strange plant which had come from an almost unknown country of Brazil, a plant which was supposed to give instant death to those who chewed its berries and got the poisonous juice down one's throat. He had done that. He had such a plant, which had been presented to him by a world traveler. For days he had carefully watered the plant, nourished it like a firstborn child, and then, when the plant was blooming and healthy, he had taken off the berries and stuffed them in his mouth. Oh, the agony of it, he thought, the shame of it. No death, but things a thousand times worse than death. Such a gastric disturbance. Never in all history, he thought, had there been such a purge. Such a purge that he would not even take himself in time to the littlest room, and the shock of the housekeeper when she had to take his very soiled clothes and pass them to the laundry woman. His face burned red at the mere thought of it. And then this latest attempt. He had sent up to London to the finest swordsmith of that city, and there had been obtained for him the best and sharpest of razors, a beautiful instrument deeply engraved with the maker's name and crest. Sir Algernon had taken that wonderful blade and stropped it, and stropped it, and stropped it, and then, with one quick slash, he had cut his throat from ear to ear, so that only the support of the spine in the neck had kept his head upon his shoulders. So he had seen himself dead. He knew he was dead because he knew he had killed himself. And then he had looked from the ceiling and seen himself on the floor with rapidly glazing eyes. He lay there in the darkness, in the turgid darkness, and thought, and thought, and thought. Death. What was death? Was there anything after death? He and his fellow subalterns and other officers in the mess had often debated the subject. The padre had tried to explain about life immortal, about going to heaven, and one dashing hussar, a major, had said, "Oh, no, padre, I'm sure that's absolutely wrong. When one is dead, one is dead. That's all there is to that. If I go and kill a boar, are you telling me that he'll go straight to heaven or the other place? If I kill him with a bullet through his heart, and I'm standing there with my foot on his chest, I can tell you that he's very much under me, dead, dead, and dead as a stuffed pig. When we're dead, and there's nothing more to it." He thought again of all the arguments for life after death. He wondered why anyone could say there was life after death. If you kill a man, well, he's dead. That's all there is to it. If there was a soul, then you'd see something leave the body at death, wouldn't you? Algernon lay there, and pondered the whole matter, wondering what had happened. Where was he? And then he had the terrible thought that perhaps it was all a nightmare and he'd had a brainstorm and was confined in an asylum for the mad. Carefully, he felt about him to see if there were any restraining straps. But no, he was floating. That's all there was to that. He was floating, like a fish in water. So he returned to wonder what it was. Death. Am I dead? Then if I am dead, where am I? What am I doing in this strange condition, floating idly? Words of the Padre came back to him. When you leave your body, an angel will be there to greet you and to guide you. You'll be judged by God Himself, and then you will have whatever punishment God Himself decrees. Algernon wondered about that whole matter. If God was a kind God, why did a person have to be punished as soon as he was dead? And if he was dead, how could a punishment affect him anyway? He was here, now, he thought, lying quietly, no particular pain, no particular joy, just lying there, quietly. At that moment, Algernon started with fear. Something had brushed by him. It was like having a hand put inside one's skull. He got an impression, not a voice, but an impression, a sensation that someone was thinking at him. Peace. Be still. Listen. For a few moments, Algernon flailed away trying to run. This was too mysterious. This was too unsettling. But he was stuck there, and so, once again, he had the impression, peace, be still, and be freed from this. Algernon thought to himself, I'm an officer and a gentleman. I must not panic. I must be an example to my men. So, confused though he was, he composed himself and let tranquility and peace enter within him. End of chapter 2.